My name is Bill Chadwick. I'm going to be co-director of the Winter Program here this year. Today we're going to take a look at the Book of Jonah, which is one of my favorite books. It has a beautiful message, I think the equal of any in Scripture, Old or New Testament. And it's a fun book. There's a lot of humor in it. I think it's too bad that when we think of Jonah, all we think of is the whale. Maybe that's from the different stories and things like that, because that's certainly not the message. You don't need to agree with anything that I say here today or anything else, any other time, I mean. My own belief, and that of many biblical scholars today, is that Jonah is written in about the 4th century B.C., at the time of the rebuilding of Jerusalem after the exile. And for those of you who aren't up on your biblical history, we've got enough time, I think, to kind of walk through the history of Israel here, beginning with Abraham and Sarah and the patriarchs back somewhere 1800 or so B.C., give or take a couple hundred years. Moses and the Exodus from Egypt around 1250, conquest of Canaan, the period of the judges, Deborah, Samuel, all those guys. David, we know quite sure, just became king of Israel around 1000. So Saul sort of begins the monarchy a little bit before David becomes king of the United Kingdom, the 12 tribes of Israel, the golden age of Israel. Solomon follows him, his son. At Solomon's death is the division of the kingdom. The 10 tribes of the north split off from Benjamin and Judah, 2 tribes in the south. Tribes in the north are called what now? Well, I guess I've got the answer up here, so it's called, are called Israel or Samaria, the capital in Samaria, and the tribes in the south called Judah, with the capital remaining in Jerusalem. Time of they're fighting each other, Israel and Judah fighting each other and everybody else for a few hundred years. 722, Samaria falls to Assyria, and its peoples are distributed around the world, and essentially Israel or the northern kingdom of Samaria disappears from history. Often hear about the 10 lost tribes of Israel. That's essentially the end of the northern tribes. Then we have the big prophets, Isaiah, Jeremiah, other prophets, minor prophets. 587, Babylon, finally, after years and years of struggle, defeats Judah, sacks Jerusalem, and carries off maybe 20,000 or so of the prime leaders to exile in Babylon. Persia defeats Babylon in about 538, and people begin returning back to Jerusalem. And not too much happens until the middle of the 5th century B.C. when under the political leadership of Nehemiah, the walls of Jerusalem are rebuilt and the temple is rebuilt. Ezra is the religious leader. And Nehemiah and Ezra do many good things as far as getting we'll call them Israelites or Hebrews, back together again after the exile. But it's my opinion, and I think the opinion of the author of Jonah, that they went overboard in their ideas of separation, of religious intolerance. If you remember, one of the things they did was anyone who had married a foreign wife had to divorce the wife and send the wife and children off, and became very, very, very strongly nationalistic, that all we care about is our country, and a feeling that that's all God cared about was their country. They were the chosen people. And it's my understanding that Jonah is written out of that setting, a setting of extreme nationalism, extreme religious intolerance, a feeling that God was their private possession and cared nothing for the rest of the world. Now I invite you to listen to the Book of Jonah. With the exception, While Jonah is in the belly of the fish, he composes a psalm, according to the way we have the book today. And I'll not read that, but otherwise I'm going to read the narrative. And I'd invite you not to read along. I'm not going to be reading out of the RSV. I'm reading a translation by Hans Wolff. And just listen. Stay awake if you can, or catch up on your rest if you can't. It's a delightful little story. Okay. There once came to Jonah, the son of Amittai, the word of Yahweh, saying, "Rise and go to Nineveh, that great city, and proclaim against it, for its wickedness has come to my attention." Now, I'll try to not make too many comments here. The word Jonah means dove. And what symbol do we think of dove? Okay, peace, Holy Spirit. The Holy Spirit symbol did not arise until New Testament times. I mean, the dove as the symbol of the Holy Spirit, and I don't know when dove became to symbolize peace, but in the Old Testament, the dove symbolized Israel, and I didn't expect any of you to know that. I feel bad about that. So if what we've got here is a parable, we've got Jonah representing Israel. Rise and go to Nineveh. And Nineveh would represent absolutely the last place you would want to go if you were an Israelite. It would be as if God said to me, "Bill, I would like you to go to Tehran and preach the Christian gospel. Get going." Well, I may head for Holden Village or someplace the other end of the world also. So, "Rise and go to Nineveh, that great city, and proclaim against it, for its wickedness has come to my attention." Then Jonah rose to escape to Tarshish, which is way over, we think probably where Spain is, way on the east end of the Mediterranean, away from Yahweh. He went down to Joppa, located a ship heading to Tarshish, paid for his passage, and went aboard to go with them to Tarshish, away from Yahweh. Now, as Yahweh threw a great wind upon the sea, so that there was a mighty tempest upon the sea, and the ship threatened to break up, the sailors feared for their lives. Everyone cried to his own God. They threw the cargo, which was in the ship, into the sea to lighten its load. Jonah, meanwhile, had gone down into the inner part of the ship, stretched out, and fell fast asleep. The captain came to him and said, "How can you sleep? Get up, call upon your God. Perhaps the God will take interest in us so that we don't perish." Then they said to one another, "Come on, let's cast lots, so that we might learn on whose account this evil has come upon us." They cast the lots, and the lot fell on Jonah. Then they said to him, "Tell us, on whose account has this evil come upon us? What is your profession? Where do you come from? What is your country? From what nation are you?" He said to them, "I am a Hebrew, and I fear Yahweh, the God of heaven, who made the sea and the dry land." Then the men feared all the more and said to him, "Why have you done this?" You see, the men had learned that he was trying to escape from Yahweh, for he had told them so. They said to him, "What shall we do with you so that the sea will calm down for us?" For the sea was growing more and more tempestuous. He said to them, "Take me and throw me into the sea, then the sea will calm down for you, for I know that this great storm has come upon you because of me." Instead, the men rowed hard to reach dry land, but were unable to do so, for the sea grew more and more tempestuous against them. Then they called upon Yahweh and said, "O Yahweh, let us not perish because of this man's life. Do not lay on us innocent blood, for you, Yahweh, have done as it pleased you." Then they took Jonah and threw him into the sea. Then the sea ceased its raging. And the men feared Yahweh greatly. They offered a sacrifice to Yahweh and made vows. But Yahweh had appointed a large fish to swallow up Jonah. And I have a visual here. It's not really a fish, it's a frog. But it's as close as I can come here. Could you all see that, or you want to see it one more time? Okay. It's really the highlight. Okay. Dan Erlander has a collection of about 200 different wind-up toys, and this is one of my favorites. No, no good. This guy's got a great mouth. It always turns that way. Okay, well. Probably all you remember about Jonah is the great frog. Okay. Jonah was in the belly of the fish 3 days and three nights. Then Jonah cried out to Yahweh from the belly of the fish. And then we have the Psalm of chapter 2, but we'll skip that. Yahweh spoke to the fish, and it vomited Jonah up onto dry land. Then the word of Yahweh came to Jonah a second time, saying, "Rise and go to Nineveh, that great city, and proclaim to it the message that I am now giving to you." Then Jonah rose up and went to Nineveh, according to Yahweh's word. At that time, Nineveh was a large city, even for God, a 3 days' journey in breadth. And Jonah set about to enter the city, walking a day's journey. Then he proclaimed, 40 more days, and Nineveh shall be destroyed." But the people of Nineveh believed in God. They proclaimed a fast, that is, they came to believe in God because of his preaching. They proclaimed a fast and donned sackcloth, everyone from the greatest to the least. For the word had reached the king of Nineveh. He stepped down from his throne, threw off his regal vestments, donned sackcloth, and sat down in the dust. Then he had these words proclaimed in Nineveh. "This is an edict of the king and his nobles. Men and beast, cattle and sheep shall refrain from eating. They shall not graze, they shall not drink. Rather, they shall don sackcloth, men and beasts, and shall call upon God mightily. And they shall turn about, each and every one, away from their wicked ways and from the violence that is in their hands. Who knows whether God will once more regret his decision and then turn from his burning anger so that we do not perish? And God saw their deeds, how they turned away from their wicked ways. Then God regretted the evil he had said he would do to them, and he did not do it. Then a great wickedness overcame Jonah, and he became angry. He cried out to Yahweh and said, 'Oh, Yahweh, was that not exactly what I thought while I was still in my own country? That is why I at first wanted to flee to Tarshish. For I knew that you are a gracious and merciful God, patient and abounding in love, who regrets the evil. So then, Yahweh, take my life from me. I am better off dead than alive.' But Yahweh said, 'Is it right for you to be angry?' For Jonah had left the city and had sat down east of the city. There he had built himself a shack and had sat down in its shade until he would see what might happen in the city. Then Yahweh God appointed a castor oil bush. It grew up over Jonah to provide shade for his head, in order to pry him out of his wickedness. Jonah rejoiced greatly because of the castor oil bush. But God appointed a worm, just as dawn was breaking the next morning. It attacked the castor oil bush, and the bush withered away. And as the sun rose, God appointed a burning east wind. Then the sun beat down on Jonah's head, and he became terribly faint. So he begged that he might die. And he said, 'I am better off dead than alive.' But God said to Jonah, 'Is it right for you to be angry because of the castor oil bush?' Then Yahweh said, 'You feel sorry for the castor oil bush, which you have neither cared for nor nurtured, which grew up within one night and perished away within one night. Should I then not feel sorry for Nineveh, the great city, in which there live more than 120,000 people who do not know how to distinguish between right and left, and much cattle?'" It's a fun story. Now, in recent years, perhaps the last century, there's been a lot of controversy surrounding Jonah, whether it really happened or whether it's a parable teaching a truth. Now, my own opinion is that it's a parable that is true, capital T, the same way as the parable of the Good Samaritan or the parable of the prodigal son are true, that it's not historical fact. And it really doesn't, you don't need to believe the way I do. Let me, I certainly believe in miracles and think that a fish could swallow Jonah, especially when you remember that he's one of the minor prophets. And in fact, there are sperm whales in the Mediterranean that have gullets large enough to swallow people. I'm told that. I don't know that personally. And I believe that if God wanted, God could have Jonah swallow the fish. And really, I've thought a lot about miracles this summer for different reasons. And I really think if you've ever seen a Polaroid camera, you know, takes a picture and comes out in 60 seconds. Or if you've ever seen a 747 take off the ground, that the miracles in the Bible are child's play compared to those things. So I have no trouble with the fact of miracles happening. There are just a whole series, though, of implausibilities if this is going to be history. And I don't want to spend a lot of time on this. Just let me list a couple of those. This after Jonah is swallowed by the fish, the storm subsides immediately. While he was inside the fish, he composed a psalm. Granted, he didn't have a lot else to do, probably. He emerged 3 days later unscathed. He walks into a hostile city, somehow knows their language, says, in 40 days, you guys have had it. And, well, you can imagine if I were to walk into Tehran and just say, well, you guys are wrong about Islam and Christianity is the way to go. Instead of being thrown into jail or killed, the people all believed, from the least to the greatest, they all believed his message and believed in God. It's a phrase there is the same phrase used to describe how Abraham believed in God. Believed in God, and the whole country immediately was converted. There are no records of that in any of the histories of Assyria. And the city of Nineveh was 3 days' journey in breadth. Archaeology shows that the city of Nineveh was never more than about 8 miles in circumference, which would give it a diameter of about 3 miles, and it would take you, you know, a mile and a half to get to the center of the city. And the plant grows up big enough to shade him in one day. So there are a lot of things that I have trouble with, and I really think it's that the picture of God that you get is sort of a picture of a magician with sort of a bag of tricks. Now that's, again, personal feeling, that I think that we need to look here for a greater truth, truth with a capital T, that we have in this book. Generally, what we've got here is a parable, an antidote to the overemphasis on exclusivity of that's going on in Jerusalem in the 4th century BC. That we have here some unknown author calling the people of Jerusalem back to their roots, back to Abraham. In the 12th chapter of Genesis, God said, go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you, and I'll make of you a great nation, and I will bless you, and through you the families of the earth will be blessed. Through you the families of the earth will be blessed. You are blessed to be a blessing. For those of you who have been through the Bethel series, you've heard that phrase many times. But this is a callback that the reason we are the chosen people of God is not for special privilege, but for responsibility to share that message of God with the rest of the world. A call back to 2nd Isaiah said that Israel is to be a light to the nations, a light to the Gentiles. The reason we are chosen is to spread that word. That's what I think is going on here in this book of Jonah. Questions or comments yet? Right. Yeah, well, I'm saying they certainly could happen. I think they don't need to be historical fact to make the point. So I don't want to spend a lot of time. I think it's a teaching tool, a parable. Like, nobody says the Good Samaritan story actually happened. Jesus told a story to illustrate a point. That's what I think is going on here. But it doesn't matter. I think the point is the same either way. Okay, let's take a look at this, sort of walk our way through it and see if we can pick up some of the points of humor and irony in this. Okay, the word of the Lord comes to Jonah. The name means Israel, so if it is a story, a teaching tool, the author would have chosen the name Jonah specifically so that we would get the picture that this is representing Israel. Arise, go to Nineveh. The worst place you could ever think to go as far as personal danger, plus a representative of abominations as far as religious practices morality. You know, in a sense, it would be arise and go to Las Vegas, or maybe there's a better example. The sort of thing that if this is being written in, say, the 4th century, that the people of Israel just disdained the rest of the world because of their religious practices. They didn't worship Yahweh. And Jonah is told to go to these people. And instead, where does he go? He heads for Tarshish, okay? Trying to get away from the Lord. And the Lord hurls a great wind upon the sea. God is sovereign over nature, and Jonah is not going to get away so easily. And Jonah is down in the ship sleeping during this big storm. What do you think about that? I mean, what would that mean, or any thoughts about that? Remind you of anything? Jesus asleep in the boat, okay. Yeah, I thought of that too when I was thinking through this and thinking the difference. Now, why is Jesus able to sleep during this storm?
He can control it.
Can control it, okay. Elmer suggested because he was out late the night before. that he didn't need to worry because confidence in his being in tune with God and things like that. Okay. And Jonah, why is Jonah able to sleep?
He was probably out late.
Well, he was probably out late. Okay.
Totally out of touch with the situation.
Totally out of touch with the situation. Didn't even realize the storm was going on. Thought he had successfully fled from God. He doesn't need to worry anymore. He's safe. Okay. In our country? In our church, maybe?
There's no place where we can hide from God.
No place we can hide from God. Okay. This is great because they say, they find him down there sleeping. Now, it looks like we've got here is a boat full of sailors from many different nationalities. Each nation would have their own god, and things start getting rough for them. The sailors, and we have this from other records, would all pray to their own god. They're trying to find out which god it is that's angry. If they can find out which god, they can placate him, and things will be okay. And they find Jonah down there sleeping. They think, well, maybe it's his god. We got to wake him up and find out. And they say, well, which god do you worship? He says, well, I am a Hebrew. I fear the Lord. Well, I worship the Lord would be another way to translate that. He's not being obedient to the Lord, but he's going to give lip service here. Well, I am a Hebrew. They say, well, who is your God? He says, well, my God is the great God, God of all heaven and earth. And now, well, first thing he says, not heaven and earth, but the first thing he says is the God of heaven who made the sea and the dry land. And then it says, then the men were exceedingly afraid. Oh, is their God that made, his God that made the sea? We are really in trouble. But the irony here is, you know, this is my God is the God who made the sea and the dry land, but Jonah thinks he can flee to Tarshish where God isn't. You know, or he thinks he's safe on the ship. So the real irony here. So the men are really terrified now, and so they you know, what have you done? Why are we mad? And this is Jonah realizes the game is up, and says, well, you know, I've been trying to run from God. And he says, throw me overboard, because it is my fault. The lots fell upon him, and this was common among the ancient people, believed that the divine will was revealed through the casting of lots, that it wasn't just chance. If you wanted to know something, you'd cast lots, and this would be God's answer. The disciples do that when they're trying to find a replacement for Judas. They cast lots and believe that this is what God has revealed. And also it was a regular practice for sailors in those days that to try to placate the gods when they would determine who was at fault would throw the person overboard. We have records of that, historical records. Either throw the person overboard or set him adrift in a boat. So Jonah says, well, throw me overboard. It's my fault. Did they do that right away? No. These are good guys. Okay, they do their best, and they row as hard as they can towards shore, but it just gets worse and worse, and they can't make it. So they say to Yahweh, you know, look, it's not our fault. We're going to throw this guy overboard. We don't want to. Evidently, this is what you want. So reluctantly, they do it, and the sea immediately becomes calm, and they pray to Yahweh and make vows. Now, we don't need to say that these people all became believers and worship Yahweh for the rest of their life, but it's certainly a picture here of receptivity to the message. If someone would only tell them about Yahweh, these people, at least in this time of great danger, are certainly ready to believe. And I think it's a good picture here of the contrast between these pagans and their trying to take care of Jonah and not throw him overboard, and then their receptivity to Yahweh contrasted with this grumpy little guy trying to flee from the Lord, representing Israel. The men feared the Lord exceedingly, and they offered a sacrifice to the Lord and made vows. Okay. Jonah spends 3 days in the belly of the fish, and when he comes out again, Yahweh says, then the word of the Lord came to Jonah a second time, saying, "Arise, go to Nineveh, that great city, and proclaim to it the message that I tell you." So Jonah arose and went to Nineveh, evidently realizing he might as well walk there. It'd be more comfortable than riding some other way that God might make for him. So he goes to Nineveh, and he walks in to this city, and the people immediately respond to his message, from the youngest to the oldest, and the king makes a decree, and the people believe in God in hopes that God will repent or change his mind, and God does. When God saw what they did, verse 10 of chapter 3, when God saw what they did, how they turned from their evil way, God repented of the evil or changed his mind, which he had said he would do to them, and he did not do it. What do you think about that? Think of God as unchangeable, right? Yeah, there are several instances where God does change his mind. Yeah, so it's a little bit of both going on there. So God changes his mind and says, well, these people repented of their evil ways, and so I'll not destroy them. And now this is where we see what was bothering Jonah in the first place. Jonah did not want to come to Nineveh, the city of heathens, because he was afraid that this would happen, that they would respond, and that God then would not destroy them. And Jonah was so disappointed that God wasn't going to destroy this city. And this is one of the most amazing speeches, I think, anywhere in literature. Chapter 4, verse 2. "I pray thee, Lord, is not this what I said when I was yet in my country? That is why I made haste to flee to Tarshish. For I knew that thou art a gracious God and merciful." This is a quotation from Exodus. Beautiful description of God. And also we find it in Psalm 103. "I knew that thou art a gracious God and merciful, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love, and repentest of evil. Therefore now, O Lord, take my life from me." God's compassion here is too much for Jonah. He says, "I hate the fact that you're not going to kill these people, these wicked people. Take my life from thee. It is better for me to die than to live." He doesn't want God to be merciful. Fits very well with this time in the 4th century when people of Israel were looking down on everyone else and wishing that God would simply do away with their enemies. Don't want mercy. And this Jonah goes out to see what's going to happen. He sits outside the city, and this plant comes up and provides him shade. And Jonah, for the first time, is really happy. So, well, hey, this is kind of a nice place got here. And there's a... Well, never mind. There's a play that we did last year about Jonah, and Jonah says when this plant comes up and provides him shade, and he goes, "Well, hey, this is great. A wonderful vacation spot you've made here, Lord. For land development, I got to hand it to you. You're the tops." And Jonah's really happy. And then the next morning, the plant dies and withers. and Jonah is back in his blue funk. And the Sirocco east hot wind comes up. Those of you who've been in Southern California, Arizona, New Mexico in the summertime know what shade is all about. And he says, oh, I've just had it. I mean, the one thing that finally made me happy was this plant, and now the plant's dead. I want to die again. And God says, you know, you are so upset about this little plant, or a big plant, but plants that came up in one day and died the next, and yet you don't want me to have compassion on the city of Nineveh, which I have created. You didn't do anything for that plant. You didn't plant it, you didn't create it, you didn't water it, you didn't nurture it or anything. These are my people in the city of Nineveh. They're my children. I created them. I care for them. There are 120,000 persons who do not know their right hand from their left. That's an old way of saying they've people who have not reached the age of discernment. In the Good News Bible, it says 120,000 children. They're saying 120,000 innocent children and also much cattle. Presumably the cattle were innocent. In that play that we did, Jonah says, well, you got a point there. There was everything wrong with those cattle. So God's saying, you want me to destroy that city of Nineveh? Granted, many of the people were wicked and evil, but there are 120,000 children who you can't hold them at fault, and there are all these cattle, and you want me to destroy them all. What's wrong with you, Jonah? So, questions or comments before I talk anymore?
I think the answer, it's a lesson to us, groups of people, or churches, congregations, or individuals would be so easy to oscillate back and forth from, like Jonah, in our comments and thoughts and beliefs
Okay.
From other people.
Okay, that's one of them. Anybody else?
I was just thinking how God involved Jonah with so much of all of creation. There was water and land, the wind, plants. You know, he was throwing everything at him to get his attention.
What was Jonah's response then?
What does it say? We don't know. It comes to a very abrupt and I think fitting end. We don't know what happens. We don't know if Jonah really gets the point, or if he gets the point and dies there in the heat, or what happens. It's a neat parable that way. It's like many of Jesus' parables. We don't know quite what people chose to do sometimes.
Well, his conscience was probably
pricked. Well, I hope so. Boy, he sure did seem to be slow on the uptake, didn't he?
There seems such a contrast between Jonah and Abraham in saving of Sodom and Gomorrah. He started, if there were 100 people saved, and we had that, there was one person, or was it 10 persons, and he saved the whole city here. He wants to throw away 120,000 children and the cattle, too.
Right. Real contrast.
So opposite.
Any other comments?
I was wondering if there was any special meaning to the numbers. You know, and sometimes, a lot of times, the numbers are symbolic. Really very great at that. I was wondering whether the 120,000 had any specific.
And not that I know, none of the commentators picked that up.
Or the 3 days. You know, why, if Nineveh was really not that big, why use that type of sign?
I don't know. Saying it's a huge, huge city, and Jonah is willing to sacrifice them all. If there are 120,000 children, one of the commentators said, in that day and age, that would mean a city of about 1 million people. Well, I think in this point, when the phrase in the Hebrew is, as we have it translated here, people who do not know their right hand from their left.
Okay, they do not know Yahweh.
Well, it's a phrase that means they have not come to the age of discernment. They can't be held responsible for their actions. So you know, just people who have not come to, you know, we have juvenile court. We don't send 15-year-olds
to adult jail because we say they're not able, that sort of thing. Or at least 10-year-olds. But I think God is making, I don't think it's in that phrase, but I think God is making the point that they are his children. It's the whole book, the contrast between Jonah representing Israel, who just is painted in a negative picture the whole way, versus the sailors, who were nice guys and didn't want to throw him overboard, and then they responded immediately when they saw that Yahweh was the true God, and then they come into Nineveh, and the people there respond immediately, and then you've got this grumpy Jonah. The other question I have to ask myself is not only who is Nineveh, but what job does God have for me to do right now that I'm trying to flee from God? God said to Jonah, go to Nineveh. And Jonah looked at that from a human point of view and said, you gotta be kidding. First of all, I don't want any compassion on those people. Second of all, that looks like a good way to get killed. So when God is calling us, I really believe, as William Barclay puts it, that God never calls us to great tasks and then leaves us alone. If we feel God calling us to something great, we can look at it not just from a human point of view, but knowing that God is going with us and that we can accomplish some amazing things like the conversion of the city of Nineveh or other things. So what is God calling me to do today that I think is too big for me or too scary or something I just don't want to do? I don't want to have compassion on poor people or gays or whoever Nineveh is for me.
My MCT to me here is that all of a sudden Nineveh, it gives me the impression, wham, they all came in phase of God. And that seems rather startling to me because it usually doesn't happen that way in the Bible or any place else. Here's this huge city and just like that, they all become followers of the Lord.
Right, that's why I think it's a parable, that a story. That personally, that's what I think, because that's one of the reasons. But I think it's an interesting truth.
What about when in the New Testament it speaks of as Jonah was in the belly of the whale, and then compares it to Christ's spending time between his death and his
resurrection
from the dead?
What do you think about that?
Well, I feel that it's a true story now.
Okay.
That's the way I think.
Anybody else?
Well, the comment was just made that over there about Christ, or about converting or changing the thoughts and lives of so many people at an instant. However, I don't think that's out of possibility with the Lord, because all things are possible. Mm-hmm. And there are accounts such as the thief on the cross, where the issue in the one word became heir of heaven. And so that's another way of looking at it.
There are no records anywhere in Assyrian history of this happening.
No.
But yeah, it could be. I don't really know what to do with that out of Matthew. It's not found in any of the other Gospels. And some scholars suggest that this is a case where Matthew is, as many of you know, I'm sure Matthew is perhaps the most Jewish of the Gospels. He's finding fulfillments in the Old Testament everywhere he can, that Jesus is a fulfillment of the Old Testament here and here and here. And some scholars suggest that this is a case where Matthew looked back and said, here's another place. Jonah was in the belly 3 days, and that's similar to Jesus being in the grave 3 days, and included it for that reason. I don't... I, I don't really do much of anything with it.
The only thing is that I don't find it hard to believe, because with God, all things are possible.
Okay, yeah, I don't want to argue that point. I think that the points are, I mean, the message of the story for people of any time is God's providence and mercy. You know, there's a wideness in God's mercy, and it includes all of us, all people on earth, and even the animals too. That's an interesting picture of the animals instructed to put sackcloth on the animals. And in my reading, it said that happened a few times. I mean, they have historical records when countries were really repenting, they even put the sackcloth on their animals, and that's kind of an interesting picture.
One other picture I get from it is an enormous amount of patience on the part of God.
Okay.
He's exceedingly patient with Jonah. Well, he could have just said, well, the heck with Jonah. Mm-hmm. You know, sink that ship and let's go get somebody else to go and do it. Instead, he appointed Jonah to go do this. And he persisted after Jonah, was patient with him, and, you know, as he fled, you know, gave him a second chance to go to Nineveh. And then after he went and proclaimed it in Nineveh, and then he went out and pouted, God still didn't forget him and abandoned that point. Still tried to say, hey, you know, you got to understand what I'm trying to do. Mm-hmm. Enormous amount of patience. Very, once again, it fits nicely with your picture of Israel. Because that's really a Jonah representing Israel. That's really what God has been doing with Israel all through the ages.
Seems to me there's a similarity between this and the robber on the cross, where Jesus said, today you'll be with me in paradise. Mm-hmm. This guy who didn't deserve anything, and yet at the end he received everything. Mm-hmm. It's the sort of thing that we run up against. We don't think it's fair. Mm-hmm. The grace of God, when it's applied to other people, it's not fair. When it's applied to us, it is. But why should all these sinners be saved and get as much as I do, who have tried to serve God all my life? Uh-huh. I think that's probably the same thing that was bothering Jonah. You know, mm-hmm. Why should these heathen be given all the blessings of us good Israelites? Uh-huh.
Sure. Yeah, but God doesn't make any discrimination.
Yeah, that's illustrated here in 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 9. The Lord is not slow about his promise, as some count slowness, but it's forbearing toward you, not wishing that any should perish, but that all should reach repentance.
Uh-huh. Good, thank you.
It's a good lesson for us not to give up on people.
Uh-huh.
Do we use the word heathen today?
Well, I don't very often.
Church. I'm church. Is that what you do?
That's hard to define too.
Yeah, that is. Okay, I'm done. Any other shots? People have been just got some great insight. Let me check my notes, make sure I am done. I've got about 16 pages here. I guess that's good. Okay, thanks very much.
Thank you.